You're listening to Locally Sourced Science, your connection to the scientific discoveries happening in the Finger Lakes community.
Listening to the February 3rd episode of Locally Sourced Science. I'm your host for this week, Nick Sagerson. I don't think anyone will make the argument that surviving is easy. Animals and plants have spent millions of years adapting to become the best at finding their food, defending themselves from the things that want to eat them, and, hopefully, passing on their genetic information to the next generation. Yet still, other forms of life have adapted to take advantage of all that hard work that's been done. Today, we're going to be giving parasites the spotlight. You've likely heard of at least a few examples of them in your life. Ticks, tapeworms, fleas, aphids, brain-eating amoebas. These are all examples of creatures that aim to take advantage of their hosts so that they can survive. Today, we're bringing you two stories about some of these parasites that have major implications for human health. Up first, Candace Limper brings us an interview from Dr. Margaret Bynoe, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Cornell University, about her research on Toxoplasmosis gondii. After that, Luisa Torres brings us an interview with Bola Oyosola, a graduate student in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Disease at Cornell, about her work on helminth, or parasitic worms, which are transmitted through the soil and live in the guts of their hosts. But first, here's your science news for the week.
Hello, locally sourced science listeners. I'm Liz Mahood, and I'm here with the science news. Born in New Hampshire in 1791, Mary Ann Kingsbury Wollstonecraft knew nothing of the internet. Over 200 years later, the botanical illustration guide she never published in her lifetime is reaching new audiences via the online library service HathiTrust. Wollstonecraft, sister-in-law to philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft and aunt to author Mary Shelley, moved to a Cuban community of American expatriates in 1828. There, she compiled a 3-volume folio of the flora of Cuba, consisting of 220 text pages and 121 illustrated plates. She makes detailed illustrations of many flowering plants, but also of pineapple and native berries. This manuscript was donated to the Cornell Rare Manuscript Collections in 1923. Now, thanks to the efforts of Cuban historian Emilio Cueto, this manuscript is being highlighted as an important aspect of Cuban history. According to Cueto, quote, "The document had been alluded to by highly relevant Cuban personalities of the 19th and 20th centuries, including Felix Varela, José Antonio Sacco, and Carlos M. Trelles, who never had the chance to see it," end quote. You can see a digital copy of this work at HathiTrust.org. Next up on the news is a report on the status of sunflower sea stars. On January 30th, researchers at UC Davis and Cornell University published the results of their 11-year study in the journal Science Advances. Between 2006 and 2017, these scientists and trained citizens completed 10,956 roving diver surveys from Southern California to Alaska to record the status of the underwater coastal environment. Before 2013, these waters were full of sunflower sea stars, a top predator of the ecosystem. However, from 2013 to 2017, the researchers recorded a 100% decline in the sea star population along the coasts of all states from Mexico to the Canadian border. Populations of these stars still persist farther north, along the coast of southern Alaska. The major reason for the decline is an epidemic, sea star wasting disease. This disease has multiple hosts, and since 2013, each host has seen drastic rates of decline from Mexico to Alaska. Sea stars on the East Coast are also not immune, but have seen lesser rates of decline than their West Coast counterparts. Researchers also believe that the disease-led decline may be exacerbated by warming ocean waters, as the disease spreads faster in warmer waters. Sunflower sea stars are an important species for maintenance of the coastal ecosystems. Without them, sea urchin populations rise, and subsequently, kelp populations fall. This ecosystem disruption may have economic implications, as healthy kelp forests maintain many populations of fish, which fisheries depend on. Finally, a new method of Zika virus testing. The Zika virus made worldwide headlines in 2015 for the birth defects it causes. Researchers at New York University's College of Dentistry and Ithaca-based microbiology firm Renix have created a test for the Zika virus that looks for biomarkers of the virus in saliva. This test was modified from an earlier version, which was created to look for HIV. This test can not only detect the presence of Zika in an individual, but it can also quantify the amount of virus present. This is useful for researchers to understand the disease severity and effects of the disease, especially for those in vulnerable groups, such as pregnant women and developing fetuses. Other methods of Zika virus detection require blood samples. These tests are more invasive than the newly developed one, are slower, and are less accurate, as the Zika virus biomarkers can disappear from the blood, even though the virus is still present. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of this new test is that the method it uses can be applied to other viruses with just a few tweaks. One of the developers of this method, Daniel Malamud, says, quote, "When we developed the HIV test, we knew we could use the same model for any infectious disease," end quote. A rapid, non-invasive test for viral infections could be a big help in curbing the spread of future viral outbreaks. Thank you for listening. I'm Liz Mahood, and that was this week's Science News.
I'm Candace Limper with Locally Sourced Science, and for a featured segment, I'm interviewing Dr. Margaret Bino, a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Cornell University. Today we're going to talk about her latest publication, where she and her constituents found a mechanism by which an ubiquitous parasite called Toxoplasma gondii causes Alzheimer's disease in mice.
T. gondii actually infects one-third to one-half of the world population.
Are people infected with
Mostly by too contaminated meat. It's believed that when you eat raw meat or undercooked meat, that we get infected. There is also some suggestions that people that has cats are highly likely to be infected.
Do we know how this parasite goes into the brain? Is that
So it's been shown that it crosses the blood-brain barrier because it can directly infect endothelial cells, which forms the blood-brain barrier. So T. gondii, because it infects such a broad scope of the population, and I'm talking about the population worldwide, it's estimated to be one-third up to one-half of the population. So this parasite has a really broad impact on society. And yet, we don't really know how it impacts us. We have snippets of ideas of issues like if a pregnant woman contracts the disease, you can get anything from abortion of the fetus to mental problems. So you see all these literature. T. gondii is implicated in Alzheimer's disease. T. gondii is implicated. But no one really have delved into it to see, well, does it induce signs of Alzheimer's disease? Because the signs of Alzheimer's disease are prominent. The major signs are induction of A-beta plaques and the induction of phosphorylated tau, an increase in hyperphosphorylated tau protein. And those are the two major hallmarks. So I decided, okay, I am going to look for those two major hallmarks to see if they show up in mice infected with T. gondii. And so we did that. We found that, indeed, T. gondii does induce these two major signs of Alzheimer's disease. This is not good. And people should know this because Alzheimer's is really, really prevalent in the world. The disease is caused by major hallmarks that causes downstream problems that these downstream problems are related to altering the signaling on neurons.
Okay, does it damage the neurons?
It damaged neurons.
And neurons don't, like, can replace themselves.
It damaged the neurons, and in some parts of the brain, some neurons are replaceable, but there are other parts where neurons are not replaceable. And we saw that in the brain of these mice, that you have really, really high, I would say, dramatic signs of cell death. We actually saw significant, even dramatic cell death. We saw cell death around the cysts that the parasite produce.
Okay, so the parasite goes into the mouse, and then it goes into the brain, yeah. And then it causes these cysts in
and
the brain.
And it forms cysts.
Oh, it forms cysts.
It forms long-lived cysts.
Is it like a protective barrier for itself?
So the cyst forms a parasitophorous vacuole.
Okay.
And this parasitophorous vacuole allows the parasite to recruit all the host cell molecules that it needs.
Okay.
And one of the host cell molecules that we think it needs is NMDA receptor. Okay. We don't know why it needs it.
So what led you to look at that receptor, that molecule, the NMDA?
Because the NMDA receptor, there are three types of receptors. These are expressed directly on the neurons.
Okay.
And they are directly involved in neuronal signaling. For neuron to function properly, it must go through these receptors.
Okay. And so when somebody has Alzheimer's, they have less receptors?
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, there are a whole lot of stuff that's going on with this thing. For example, one of the early signs of Alzheimer's is loss of olfactory sensitivity.
So what does that mean?
You can't smell.
Okay.
There is a progressive loss of smell. And so that's one of the early signs of Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And guess what? In areas where we see the cysts are prevalent, we saw complete depletion of neurons in these areas. There is other factors that the parasite cause, but I'm going to actually stick with the signs of Alzheimer's.
Yeah,
and the reason that I'm sticking with that is because of the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease.
Is that going up?
It's not going away.
Okay.
In other words, it's not less.
Okay.
And there is still no cure for Alzheimer's disease. And if it continues on the trajectory that it is, it can destabilize society. The financial burden that it would put on us is going to be so exorbitant that we would not be able to sustain it. These are the conundrums of this disease. But I'm not saying that all the Alzheimer's in the world is contributed by Tic Gondii. I'm not saying that at all. Based on the studies that we have done now, I would like to say that it has the potential to contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, even knowing how this parasite can cause Alzheimer's-like disease, or the disease itself, is super important to identifying targets.
Yeah, and mechanism, to identify mechanism. And we see that one of the mechanism is usurping the NMDA receptor, which is expressed on neurons. And without the NMDA receptor, you cannot get proper neuronal signaling. So which means you're causing defects within the neuron. They're not going to function properly. And that itself, you can see how that, if you not have a properly functioning neuron, that is going to lead to madness. So my point is, because of the extensiveness of this parasite and it's successful in infecting people, we really need to take a deeper look, to look more extensively to see, where does it contribute to these neurological diseases? Because it's estimated that it causes a whole range of disorders, including Alzheimer's. It's linked to Huntington's disease. No, I'm not kidding you.
I thought that was
Parkinson's
a genetic thing.
Disease.
Yeah.
So a lot of these things are not only genetic. They are components of environment and genetics and everything else.
Okay.
Yeah. So my thing is that we don't know exactly how Toxoplasma gondii induces Alzheimer's disease. We see that it does, though.
So say I was infected with this parasite and I was pregnant. What would be my symptoms? What would it be like?
You could get abortion. The parasite could develop in the fetus.
Okay.
And that fetus
in the fetus's brain?
In the fetus's brain.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And that could lead to a whole spectrum of disorders. That is why it's called...
So is anybody researching that aspect too?
No, that's what I'm saying. Nobody's touching that? Nobody is touching that as far as I see. Yes.
That's surprising to me that nobody's looking into that aspect. Even, I mean, nobody's looking into this parasite, really,
this is
right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So people are looking into the parasite. Don't get me wrong. A lot of people are studying this parasite.
In what organism?
In mice.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
But they are studying its life cycle. In other words, nobody... So you know why we did this? We did this because I keep hearing this, I keep reading this, the literature, and finding Toxoplasma gondii is implicated in Alzheimer's disease. That's all there is. You find nothing
Nobody's
else.
Nobody's trying to find the mechanism.
No. And so I decided, you know what? I am sick and tired of hearing this. I know how to look for signs of Alzheimer's disease. Let me look for them and see if I find them.
And you found something.
And I find not only something, the biggest things I find, right?
Yeah.
So we find that we see that the parasite is getting rid of NMDA receptor. And we see, and we didn't even know this. We just wanted to see whether it's inducing A-beta and A-beta plaques and hyperphosphorylated tau. Those are the two major hallmarks. And we see that it does. Up to this day, we are the only one, I'm sure, that shows that it causes the reduction in NMDA receptor signal. Also, you have a ton of neuronal death. That's the other thing. We saw that where the parasite is highly prevalent, and these are areas that are critical. For example, in the hippocampus, part of the brain that it's shaped like a hippopotamus, they said. I still can't see it. but regardless, the hippocampus is involved with synaptic plasticity. And synaptic plasticity is the rejuvenation of the brain. It's a remodeling of the brain after damage. So for example, if you have a stroke or if you have some sort of brain damage, the ability, the synaptic plasticity is the ability of the brain to recover, to try to recover itself.
Mm-hmm.
So parts of the brain that's damaged is going to try to remodel itself to recover.
So I didn't know that the brain could do that.
Yeah, it does that.
Because I thought once it's damaged, it's...
No, it tries to repair itself as best as possible. So that remodeling is called synaptic plasticity.
Okay.
It tries to adapt.
Is that when it makes different connections to different neurons?
Yeah,
okay.
That's part of it. Okay. So, for example, recently my mother caught a stroke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so she was completely paralyzed on the right side. And now she is, for the first time, she is beginning to wiggle her fingers.
How long has it been since the initial stroke and fingers?
About 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's happening.
So this is what I'm trying to tell you. Before, she couldn't, there was nothing there, no signal there.
Okay.
Now, she's beginning to move her fingers, and that is tremendous. That is fantastic. So it's possible to, not fully, you're never going to recover fully from a stroke, but you can recover enough that you can actually get back movement,
mm-hmm,
and to get back some function.
I guess, like, what do you say to people? watch out.
I would say that we need, to be honest with you, I would say that we need to take a more serious look at this parasite, you know, and it may not be responsible for all the Alzheimer's disease in the world,
right,
but it could be responsible for a significant number. This parasite has the potential to cause major, major, major brain damage that could result in all these neurological disorders. So why are we taking it lightly? Why don't we start taking it seriously and do something?
This is Candace Limper, and you just heard my interview with Dr. Margaret Bynoe, a neuroimmunologist at Cornell University.
Hello, listeners. This is Luisa Torres with Locally Sourced Science. We are here today with Bola Oyesola, a fourth-year graduate student in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Disease in the Baker Institute at Cornell University. She is here to talk to us about helminths, parasitic worms that survive by feeding on a living host. These parasites can cause a wide spectrum of diseases in humans and other animals, from mild to potentially deadly. We live in the United States, where we have access to clean water and clean food in most places. Why is it important to study parasites and specifically helminth infections, which is what you study in your lab?
It's important to study helminth infections because there are still some areas, like rural areas, where there is still high prevalence of helminth infections. So places like Alabama has high prevalence of helminth diseases. It's important that we study these parasitic diseases because they are still one of the neglected diseases in the world. Like, there's no much funding for this research, despite the morbidities that you have as a result of this infection. And, you know, not just humans, but our pets and farm animals are also infected. So it's still a neglected area, and I feel like we can do more.
How do helminth infections occur?
Well, there are different routes. So through ingestion of the parasite is one way. For example, if you eat raw or uncooked meat, that's one way that people get helminth parasite. Another way is through handling or playing with your pets. And if you're not very hygienic, that's another easy way of getting this parasite. In more rural areas and where there's no access to clean water, where they use, you know, sewage water, one way is through skin penetration. So these parasites have hooks and suckers that they can use to penetrate through the skin.
Humans and other animals get infected the same way.
Yeah,
same route.
Yeah, pretty much so. Another way, which I forgot to mention earlier, is that there are some mosquitoes that carry these worms as well, that carry the larvae of the worms. And so if you get beaten by these flies and vectors, you can get those parasites as well. So the different routes. So farm animals and humans actually have pretty similar ways of getting infected.
How does the immune system deal with those infections?
That's really a really cool question, and it's one of the things we study in the lab. Like, so if you get infected with a parasite, how does the body react to this parasite? Mm-hmm. And one way the body does is that it sends all these, I would say, soldiers, like cells, immune cells, out to help to deal with the parasite. As you get infected, we don't really know what is happening, but when you start seeing symptoms like diarrhea, that is an evidence of the immune system working.
Can your body get rid of the parasite completely, or can it stay in your body for a very long time?
That's a good question. The parasite can actually stay in pets or humans or mammalian species for a long time. There's been reported cases of people that have parasite for 30 years without knowing. So they can stay there for a long time.
Is there evidence that the parasite causes problems later on? You just said that you can live with it for 30 years and not know it. So is there evidence of health problems beyond what you see after an initial infection?
They are blood-sucking parasites that if they stay for a long time, you can imagine that they will keep sucking the blood of the host, and eventually you have other symptoms like anemia. Yeah. So there are different effects, long-term effects of having this parasite.
There has been some talk in the scientific community about using parasites to treat allergies. What is the rationale behind that idea? And do you think there is promise in that approach?
Yeah, I would say that there is a possibility that that would happen. But this is an area under, you know, intense research. And, you know, maybe we're not yet there. There is this idea that we co-evolved with these parasites. And then the fact that we're living in a very hygienic condition and we're no longer exposed to this parasite, then the body starts reacting abnormally to factors that we should not be reacting to, which is what we see in allergy. Mm-hmm. Like I said, this parasite in the host, they produce factors, they secret factors that tells the immune system to shut down. So if we can get those factors from the helminth and then understand what those factors are actually doing, then we can begin to synthesize those factors in the lab and then use it to, you know, treat allergy conditions. I think that's the long-term goal of trying to understand what is happening or what those helminth parasites are producing.
So not necessarily infecting a person with the parasite itself, but rather using, say, proteins from the parasite to, yeah.
Yeah.
So that would be safer.
Yeah, I think that's the best option. Yeah, I think that's the long-term goal.
Right.
Yeah.
That was Bola Oyersola talking to us about helminth infections. I am Luisa Torres, and you are listening to Locally Sourced Science.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Locally Sourced Science. If you have ideas for future segments of the show, or thoughts or questions you'd like to share with us, you can find us on Twitter at FLX Science Radio, on Facebook at Locally Sourced Science, or on Instagram at locally.sourced.science. Today's show featured interviews by Candace Limper and Luisa Torres. Liz Mahood produced the Science News. This episode featured music by Joe Lewis and Lee Rosevere. Locally Sourced Science is produced at WRFI in Watkins Glen and Ithaca.